body that you look at the causes of the crisis. It's basically backward-looking, diagnostic, as opposed to much else. We're not going to put you under the oath tonight, but you are subject to USC 1001, which is a provision of law which basically says it's not a good idea to misrepresent a federal investigator. We are recording this, and if you would speak clearly into the recording device and not answer with nods and shakes of the head, et cetera, I'll remind you.
Okay.
If by chance any of our questions are not at all clear or not particularly clear, do stop us and we'll rephrase and do that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I'm joined by several colleagues from different parts of our operation. Tom Stanson is one of our investigators, or is one of our researchers, so he tends to ask the big picture questions.
Okay.
Bob, Carl, and Chris are all investigative staff, so they may be asking you stuff about particular documents, and Clara down at the end is making sure all of our technology works and is our East paralegal. So let me start with just a few questions on collateral calls, if I might.
Sure.
First is, we're particularly interested in the set of collateral calls that were made vis-a-vis AIG. Did you have a personal involvement in that, or any knowledge of that particular?
I would say fundamentally did not have a personal involvement, although later in the process, substantially later in the process, when there was some dispute over the calls, it did get elevated to my level.
And when it was elevated to your level, what, if anything, was your role?
I had no relationship with the company, so I was not in any dialogue with AIG as a trading counterparty. My role more internally, because I many years ago had a background in the mortgage desk, I spent a little bit of time making sure that I was very comfortable with the marks that we were using to call collateral and post collateral to other counterparties.
Okay, and to the extent you recollect, do you have remembrance of how those marks were set? I mean, these are famously difficult securities to price. So can you give me a few moments in terms of how you actually set those marks?
Sure, absolutely. I'd be happy to. You know, look, our fundamental premise at Goldman Sachs is mark-to-market. Every security within this building gets marked on a daily basis. And if it can get marked intraday, we mark it intraday. Because the more accurately you mark, the more accurately you risk manage. Our fundamental being for marking books is trading activity. So we let trades override every other input we have in the market system. So if you could somehow calculate a fair value, it comes out at X, but the trades are taking place at Y, we mark our book at Y, because Y is the accurate replacement cost. And mark-to-market accounting, the fundamental basis of mark-to-market accounting is replacement cost. If this counterparty disappeared, how could I replace that risk to keep myself unharmed? So we believe that mark-to-market on trades is replacement cost. So where my involvement was, and I don't want to over-exaggerate my involvement, it was late in the process, doing some checking, sitting with the desk and making sure that their marks were appropriately, I was actually able to observe us making two-way markets to bona fide clients, watching those markets being made, watching us transact in the times we transacted. Unfortunately, we didn't transact that much, but we were ready, willing, and able to buy or sell. And seeing where they made those two-way markets and seeing where they were marking the book. So I got very comfortable that our marks represented prevailing prices in the market.
Okay. And since this is a world of tranches and vintages and things of that nature, how did you sort out those differences? I mean, if you arguably had, for example, hypothetically, a 2006 set of mortgages upon which other securities were built versus some of the things that AIG had, which were 2004 or 2005, How did you make those kinds of correlations, if you will?
Well, whenever possible, mm-hmm. to the best of our ability, we would try and trade those individual tranches. because you're right, 2004 may not correlate with 2005, which may not correlate with 2006. High FICOs, low FICOs, subprime, prime. You know, every time you put a different, a different dissemination on a security, it has a different price discovery. So our overall emphasis was trying to create price discovery in those markets directly by creating bid-offer spreads, and also by talking to other clients and talking to other counterparties and finding out what they thought these securities were worth. Where would you bid for that? Where would you offer that to me? And there was enough activity going on with enough people to try and actually figure out over a, I would say, weekly period, that I was very comfortable that our marks were representational to the market. Mm-hmm. And we try to stay away from intuitive correlation models, although you have to use them to some extent, because not every CUSIP, not every security trades, even on a weekly basis. So we did have interpretatory correlated models where you did have to put factors in. But in the AIG situation particularly, a large percentage of the CDS that we traded was on single names. So single names, it's not that much of a mystery. You know, when you're looking at super senior in a single name, a single name is a single name. The tranche portfolios is more difficult because you've got an amalgamation of a bunch of CUSIPs.
Now, my understanding is that there are a variety of CDS agreements you have with AIG, but an apparently common or reasonably common element was a process to resolve differences in view in terms of marks by going through some semi-formal process that would go out to the market and essentially do a survey.
Mm-hmm. A broker poll.
Was there, my understanding further is that no such broker poll was done. One, is that true? And if true, given your ability to get the information, why didn't people use that polling process to resolve this?
A, I don't know if a broker poll was done, to be honest with you. B, to be candid of how the market works, me going out and talking to counterparties and getting feelings of where a market is and indications, much easier than someone creating a written transcript of where they're willing or where they're willing to transact in a security. And I would say that's the basic problem. And when you put the broker poll out there, you're reliant upon the brokerage community to be responsive and to care about what they're doing and to spend some time and some effort with no potential ability for them to receive any compensation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So we have found over periods of time, in fact, in this period of time, you would get relatively shoddy responses back from a broker poll. And to me, broker poll is nice, but someone willing to commit capital to buy or sell security is a lot more interesting to me than someone saying, I think it's here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair point. Now,
broker poll would be the same to you as dealer poll.
Yeah, broker poll, dealer poll. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Now, AIG, as I understand it, pushed back in a variety of ways. Were you part of any conversations or meetings that said this is not correct because...
As I said, I never had a conversation with AIG directly.
Okay.
Some of the very few senior conversations were reported back to me. Mm-hmm. And as I said, my role, if I had any role in small, was in making sure that we were... completely comfortable with our marks. And by the way, I should add to that, I was doing it from the trading desk standpoint. There was a whole slew of people doing it from the control side of the house simultaneously, using their network of information to make sure that they agreed with the marks.
Okay, and did that network of information include talking to people about actual trades or willingness to trade at certain prices?
So remember, that group would have... they would have ability to see every trade as it went through the system. So the minute we do a trade in the organization, it gets entered into our risk management system, which feeds through our operation system, which feeds to our margin system, which feeds to our payment system, They would see the actual trades take place. And so they wouldn't see the what I would call market rhetoric on a day-by-day basis. But they would see the actual factual trades, who bought, who sold, size of trade, price, counterpart.
Now, at some point in the process of your of the firm's relationship with AIG, there was, as I understand it, an effort which I think was communicated by your CFO, that may not have been the originator of the strategy, in essence, to split the baby in terms of your marks were at four, they said they were way less than that, and you would simply say, okay, we'll accept two, or something of that effect. Does that sound like a real statement of what was going on at, in the later stages of your collateral call?
As I said, I was not part of those conversations.
Okay.
So hearing it secondhand, or maybe firsthand from our CFO, not witnessing the conversation, I believe there was a discussion earlier in the process when the differentiation marks was big, but not enormously big, mm-hmm. to just come to some short-term compromise for that period of collateral call, not waiving our rights, knowing that we would come back to this every week, every day, because the markets move. Mm-hmm. So when you decide to settle a call today, the trading protocol is, okay, based on information up till today, we'll agree here. But tomorrow, the market's going to move. If it moves in your favor, we're going to give you back money. It moves against you, you're going to give us money. We don't waive our rights to ask for that money. Based as more trades, more transparency, and you as the counterparty or client get more comfortable with where trades are actually taking place. To me, it was a bridge to get them more educated. And in the risk management world, the way we risk manage, when we don't receive collateral, there's a cost to us. So the fact that we're paying out collateral on the other side of these transactions, we clearly have a motivation and a best interest to receive the collateral in on the other side, because we're borrowing less money to pay collateral in a match book. So we were using what we consider to be our best efforts to bring collateral in to pay collateral out. So our CFO in that thought process would say, hey, look, we're borrowing 2x. Let's split the baby and only borrow 1x for a couple nights. Let's try and get the counterparty to be more understanding where the market is, and we'll get the other x.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
And
but it was never a situation where we said, okay, we're done on this, we'll take less than what we're due. Yeah. It was that, give us the collateral now.
We were clearly trying to borrow less money to finance. So look, if you've got a book here, a client here and a client here, we're just a conduit, and this match, all we really have is credit risk. So we're paying on this side every night, receiving on this side, or receiving on this side and paying on this side based on the market moves.
May I ask a question there, please?
Sure.
You guys were real good in terms of your contractual arrangement with AIG. Were your counterparties as rigorous with you so that, in fact, it was a matched book, that whatever it was you were demanding from AIG, in fact, would be going the other way?
In the big picture level, yes. I would say CUSIP by CUSIP, security by security, there's always going to be differences. Mm-hmm. And we have collateral disputes every day of our lives. But 99 out of 100, we split the baby every night.
Okay.
You know, we just split it and say, tomorrow it comes out, because tomorrow I'm going to owe you money, you're going to owe me money. So in the situation where, I would say yes in that. And remember, when we mark our books, we have the longs and the shorts, we pay and collect on the same number. We don't arbitrage the pay and collect.
Thank you.
Okay, if that's the question. So we're in this situation. We've got a pay and a collect. Mm-hmm. And we're paying out on our pay because we're paying out against our marks. We're paying 2x out. We were happy. We were using prudent risk management trying to get some of that in. Because if not, this entity just borrows that money, because we will not collect, we will not pay our clients over here because we don't get paid over here. That's not these clients' problem that we didn't get paid over here. Mm-hmm. They know Goldman Sachs is a counterparty. They know Goldman Sachs is a counterparty. So we end up having to finance that.
Okay. Now, switching topics on you slightly, give me a sense of how the marks with respect to the claims you're making vis-a-vis AIG relate to the sales price you might use on sales of securities that you're selling in the marketplace. So if I mark something, or you mark something, let's say 80% of its original par, Does that mean, what does that mean for the sales price of the XYZ Abacus security that you might be selling that might include the same tranches or similar kinds of tranches? Since I, interpolation has to be part of this process.
I think I understand the question. There's one price for security. Now, is there a bid offer spread around that fair value? So if the security is worth five, mm-hmm. let's say it's worth five, so we would make a market 4.75 where we'd buy and 5.25 where we'd sell. If we were using that security in another security, it would go in somewhere between 4.75 and 5.25 because that's the price of that security. Mm-hmm. There's one set of prices at Goldman Sachs.
Okay. And is there, I mean, given your numerical example, is there a standard markup or more or less usual markup that you would add to what you understand to be sort of the purchase price of a set of a security versus what you'd sell it?
There's no such thing as a standard markup. I would say in a 4.75 and 5.25 market, we're happy to buy at 4.75, we're happy to sell at 5.25. If we buy and sell at 5 all day long, we don't make any money.
Right.
We have a lot of overhead and no revenue.
Right. But is there either an aspirational markup or a, other than a bazillion percent, something you would just expect to be reasonable and numbers that would be unreasonable in terms of your markup, your
there
cost?
There really is not, and I understand the question. Mm-hmm. So in an agency market, where you make me your agent to go out and acquire something, I go out and acquire it, then I charge you a fee, a commission. So the equity market, a lot of it is done on an agency basis. In these markets, they're non-agency markets, they're principal markets. And what normally happens, like 99.999% of the time, is we buy things when clients want to sell them. We sell things when clients want to buy them. Those time intervals never overlap. So we're always creating inventory, both on the long and short side, to facilitate our clients. So it's not like I go, hey, I bought security at 5, I should sell it at 5.25. I bought security at 5, I sold three other securities to hedge it. 6 months later, someone actually came in to buy that security. I may sell it at 1, or I may have sold it at 60. But that depends on where these securities over here that I hedged it with are. So it's not like I could ever tell you where I actually bought a security and where I sold the exact same security and what did I mark it up or what did I mark it down. It has a prevailing price based on current market conditions.
Okay, fair point. Apropos of markups, et cetera, did the company have an experience with the amount it would get out of, say, a synthetic CDO that would be built on or reference RMBS securities? I mean, would you, for $1 billion, say, Abacus deal, or $1 billion other CDO deal, what would be your expected return to the firm?
If you're talking about just an underwriting fee,
I'd be interested in everything you might have been able to secure out of, say, $1 billion synthetic CDO.
It's virtually impossible for me to say. I mean, some of those transactions, we would have made a pure underwriting fee, which would have been highly disclosed of what we were getting paid to act as the underwriter. Because literally, you know, you might have come to me as a client and said, hey, I want to buy XYZ. I can source XYZ from here, and I will underwrite it and sell it to you, and that's my fee, and I'm happy to facilitate.
Right.
There are other transactions where we would have been involved with 50 or 100 different counterparties. We would have used our balance sheet. We would have warehoused securities. We would have put securities on our balance sheet. And what you ended up making at the end of the period of time, and it could be negative, just so you know, could be negative, was somewhat unpredictable.
And I actually asked some other folks this question this morning, but just to the extent you are aware, is there a place where the profit or loss, essentially the P&L, if you will, for an individual CEO might be found within your system?
An individual?
Yeah.
I'm sure if you dig down in the bowels, there is, because every security in the firm sits inside our system, security by security. You have to carry security by security, QSIP by QSIP. At a desk level, a management level, we wouldn't see that. But if you literally dug down into the billions of line items within the firm, I'm sure you can find, because you would have to know, where you purchased everything, where you sold it, because that would become your taxable gain or loss.
Oh, of course, it would be a taxable gain, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, and that would that include things like CDS you might have bought or sold?
Everything. Everything we buy comes into the price. Everything we sell goes out of the price. And at the end of the year, when we pay our taxes, we have to know what price we bought, how long we held it, and when it went out.
I think Tom was asking a different question
okay.
now. You were talking about the P&L for a CDO. So any CDS that referenced that CDO, you think if you went into the CUSIP of the CDO, you would find...
No. No.
Okay.
You'd
find
I wasn't asking that question, but
that's
a great question.
What I'm saying is, yeah. What I'm trying to say is, you would never find the bundle. You have to drill down to the individual CUSIP. That's how we would end up carrying it, is CUSIP by CUSIP.
Okay.
So bundle X, if you unpeel bundle X, there might be a thousand line items in there. Because it may be one CUSIP, but we could have bought it over 6 months
mm-hmm.
at 50 different prices with 50 different days of holding period. So is it long-term, short-term? But we ultimately, in the bowels of Goldman Sachs, have to know that.
Right. And just to raise a variation on what Janet was raising with you, if, for example, in a synthetic context, referenced a particular CUSIP and they did it multiple times, I would also be able to find that down in the bowels as well?
If a synthetic was created that represented CUSIP, remember, we didn't trade the CUSIP. So
right.
when you get to synthetics, you have a whole different set of issues.
Right.
Right. Because by the mere nature of it being synthetic, we didn't go out and acquire
mm-hmm.
the security. So we would reference this CUSIP or the security. We reference the security. We would use a reference price on the creation of that synthetic that we would all, usually buyer, seller, underwriter, would agree is the prevailing fair market price at the time of the creation of the synthetic.
Okay. One of the things we're interested in is the potential for multiplication of the effects of the financial crisis. So the basic notion would be, okay, you start with a real security, which or a thing which relates to real mortgages, and then you build various synthetics on top of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
That one might argue that you get a loss if that goes down, but then you get multiple losses for every one of the synthetics that references that real thing that went down. If I wanted to explore that hypothesis, how would I figure out what Goldman did with respect to using the same CUSIP multiple times?
What you said is correct, but that was only half the equation.
Okay, tell me.
With multiple gains. Remember, when you create a synthetic, by the mere nature of being synthetic, there have to be a buyer and a seller.
Right. Yep.
So at the end of the game, to the net economy for the net disposable income is zero.
Unless the loser is a systemically important institution.
Yeah. It's still net zero.
Right, it's a zero sum game.
It's a zero sum game.
Yeah.
It's a zero sum game. So for every multiplied lost dollar, there was a multiplied gain dollar. And the multiplied gain dollar may have kept someone who was systemically important in business.
Sure. Okay, I think you answered that. Mm-hmm. You answered my second question, which would have been, is this strategy having an effect on the real economy? It sounds like you would suggest it's zero or neutral.
It's zero or neutral. Just like futures contracts are, just like all of the other financial instruments that are zero sum.
Okay. Now, can I ask a question?
Yeah, please, sir. I mean, this really gets back to what is an informed investor and what isn't. And it strikes me that you guys are playing in a league where you understand things that a whole bunch of people in the market that may be qualified investors, whatever that means, may not understand. Is that your perception, having now looked back over the last several years, that, you know, Michael Lewis's old book, The Fool in the Market, that there were systematic types that, in fact, simply didn't understand what they were doing?
I totally believe that our clients and our counterparties knew exactly what they were doing.
At all levels of knowledge, meaning they knew the kind of bets they were making, the implications for themselves, etc.
I was shaking my head, so the answer is yes for the tape. Yes, and we have enough discussion with our clients to be very comfortable that they all knew what they were doing. And just so you know, the clients created these products. We didn't create the products. We created the clients to facilitate. We created the product to facilitate client need.
But you get one half of that from a client. But then somehow you got to find somebody in the market to take the other half, whichever side that is.
Correct.
So that's a client, but you're going to them at some point because you've got it on your books.
Correct. I mean, sometimes you can find both sides. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you could find one and a half sides. Sometimes you find both sides, and then 2 days later, someone wants out of a side. That's the nature of our business, to stand ready, willing, and able to facilitate.
Well, let me ask you something on that. I mean, we've seen documents that Goldman's produced where, you know, you're extending warehouse lines to loan originators. You're then buying the loans from the loan originators, packaging them into securities, selling them off to investors, and making money. Now, that's not because... completely anyway, because clients are coming to you saying we want securities, right? Because Goldman's looking to make money in the securitization business, right?
Well, if clients didn't want to buy the securities, we wouldn't provide the warehouse lines, and we wouldn't securitize. We could securitize anything. You have to ultimately sell it. And if you look at the history of the mortgage market securitization, just about every mortgage prior to 2006 got securitized.
Right.
So it was a normal course, and yes, we had numerous clients all the time. They were calling us, looking at us for different securitizations. You know, they wanted scratch and dent auto. Well, why do you want scratch and dent auto? Those are sort of used automobiles. Scratch. So, well, we want them because they yield 11%. Well, are you sure you want them? Yeah, we know the people that buy scratch and dent autos. We know there's going to be default rates. We understand. That's why it yields 11%. So I would disagree. I would say that we had a constant flow of acquirers of securitized tranches. And the whole mortgage market was premised. Fannie and Freddie were premised on the securitization market.
Right.
I don't understand how that plays in with this. My sense was Fannie and Freddie were quite a different market, or to a significant extent a different market in terms of FICO scores, LTVs, and so on.
No, my point was the entire mortgage market, all the way down to the government agencies, was premised on we can securitize our mortgage inventory anytime we want.
Okay.
That was my overarching thought, was that the securitization market allowed the home mortgage market to grow, it allowed the credit card industry to grow, it allowed the automobile industry to grow. Those were the primary drivers of securitization. Mm-hmm. So in essence, it allowed consumer credit to grow through the shadow banking system.
And did that have an effect on underwriting quality, since there was this capacity to securitize large numbers of mortgage loans?
I don't think so. I think that underwriting quality, you know, even though there's a lot of assets out there, mm-hmm. there's a lot of securitizers. We were actually quite small. We were always trying to figure out how to get bigger in the space. But, of course, we didn't manufacture our own securities. So if you originate loans and you originate automobile loans, you originate credit cards, and you're a Citibank or Bank of America or Waco, you can manufacture your own portfolios. Mm-hmm. We always had to buy portfolios. We had to warehouse to get the portfolios to be able to securitize. Mm-hmm. So there was enormous competition in the securitization space. But I think competition, arm's length competition, and, you know, lead you into another place you may or may not want to go, lead you into the rating agencies to some extent, where people hung a lot of trust on the ratings of rating on the ratings.
When you would buy private label security, say a AAA, did you have the capacity to go behind the AAA and understand the real quality of that security?
Did we have the capacity? We probably didn't have it. We had the knowledge. We probably didn't have the capacity.
Okay.
Okay. I'm getting a little technical. So if I buy a pool of 1,000 loans, I had the knowledge to check all 1,000. Would I have had the capacity to go through 1,000? We sampled, yes, we did a lot of sampling, enormous amount
so
of sampling.
So you could figure out whether, if you, before you bought a AAA-rated private label security, you could figure out whether it was really worth a AAA to you.
We could figure out, based on the guidelines the rating agency had given us, if it was AAA.
Let me go farther. Some institutions bought huge amounts of AAA-rated securities that absolutely blew up. And in fact, this has been a pattern. There were mobile homes in 2003, and then subprime private label securities blew up in the current crisis, even though they were AAA rated. My question is really, as you were in the market dealing with these AAA rated private label securities, did you have a sense that maybe their credit quality was worse than the rating on them?
We might have had a sense. I mean, you talk about, so maybe I misunderstood your question. When you asked 5 minutes ago about underwriting standards,
underwriting
were you talking about ours at the securitization level or at the origination level?
Actually, at the origination level, and so in my next question
okay.
would have been...
I think the underwriting standards at the securitization level did not deteriorate.
Okay.
I think it's proven now that the underwriting level at the asset, at the consumer level, did deteriorate.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty manifest.
Yes.
But my next question is...
I didn't hear an answer to mine.
I
need to understand this. If somebody buys $100 billion of AAA-rated private label subprime securities... Well, actually, I know a company that did it. So say,
okay.
Yeah, say $1 billion.
It wasn't
ordinary companies, no. But if they buy this, do they have the capacity to check the real credit quality of what they're buying, or are they forced to rely on the rating because that is really all that one can get enough information to do?
I think it's more of the latter. Just in the way these things transact in the market, you don't have the time and effort to be able to go trade to check every loan in the pool. But you also had an early rejection. Remember, you bought these things and you could reject securities that underperformed or failed
mm-hmm.
in the first 30, 60, 90 days. So if you ended up getting some bad securities in the tranche, you would reject them out. So that was the prophylactic in place, was, okay, take the pool, you know, do your spot check, buy the pool, then you've got your 90 days to see how the securities perform, and you can reject. Buyer can reject back to the seller.
Are we talking okay. about pools of loans?
No, I'm talking
about the AAA
security on a pool of
loans. Okay, I'm talking about individual loans.
Yeah.
So you're talking
okay.
about...
I'm simply trying to understand...
Okay. Okay. Can I try this?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Erase that part of the table.
Erase that part. What I was talking about was when I would go... When Citigroup would sell me $100 million of loans, that was what
got
I...
Got it.
So what I think your question was if we bought a AAA security that was rated AAA by Moody's or S&P, did we have the ability to look at that AAA rating and say, not correct... rated too high because of things that we could see or people in the market, the industry could see.
Yeah, I would say if you're already buying securities that are rated, you're going with the ratings. You're trading the rating.
But that doesn't answer the question.
About your question, though, is your question simply, no, Gary, no, here's the question. The rating agency set a bunch of criteria to define something as a AAA. That's all it is. It's a AAA if it meets their criteria.
Right.
Is your question whether or not you have the capacity to evaluate whether or not this security meets the criteria?
No.
Or is it, because we have no...
Did you have the capacity to understand that maybe this AAA security is a lot more risky than a AAA might...
No, but here's the question. We see a question that almost doesn't have a context, because there's no such thing as a quote AAA security, except in the context as to how the rating agency defines
it. I'll drop the question.
That's the only question. I'm not arguing.
Let me try it this way.
Okay.
Did you guys...
I'm sure you're asking it right, and I'm screwing it up.
No, did you guys know what the rating agency's criteria was for rating, you know, straight RMBS, CMBS, structured securities, et cetera?
Structured securities, yes, they put it up on their website.
Okay. And then did Goldman have a view, or did you have a view, about whether or not that criteria was sufficient? I mean, if you saw a Moody's or an S&P say, okay, we're looking at Abacus, and we're going to say the attachment point is here so that the super senior is this much and these A notes are AAA and then the bottom 20% is BBB, would you be saying, yeah, but we know that criteria, and you know, if we were doing our models and our criteria, it might be something different.
I'm not sure it's relevant, because at the end of the day, ultimately the client who I'm here to service would tell me, look, I want the highest yielding AAA security you could find, which means optimize to make it as high yielding as you can, meaning put the mix in there as favorable to me.
Isn't it relevant if you guys think, for example, that the attachment point shows that the AAA and super senior is 80% of the tranches, and you guys really think it's 60% of the tranches?
But at the end of the day, if the insurance client or the client manager of their portfolio comes to me and says, I want AAA, and he says, I don't really care what you think. I want Moody's rate at AAA because I have an investment mandate that has to hold AAA. But by the way, I really need an 11% yield bogey. Please solve that equation for me. And I can say, oh, there's that security out there that's trading. It's rated at AAA. It's yielding about 11%. You know, maybe it's had 6% default rates. Client says, well, look, that's a little risky for me, or I want to buy. So at the end of the day, it's our obligation to provide the client what knowledge the market is giving him, so default rates, yields, those things, and then the client makes an ultimate decision to buy or not to buy or to sell.
Sure, but does that equation change when, for example, in late 2006 and 2007,
you guys are, for example, getting closer to home, and one of the ways you're doing that is getting rid of inventory by throwing it into securitizations. Don't you get a better price if you have that deal rated higher by the rating agencies?
We get the prevailing price for that rated security.
Okay.
Can I take one more crack?
Sure.
Citibank comes to you and offers you $100 million worth of loans. When they offer them to you, you must have some idea what these things are going to be rated based on...
Mm-hmm.
They make representations to you about that pool.
Mm-hmm.
And that pool, you know, ties in to what Moody's or S&P will rate AAA.
What percentage?
What percent of it? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Does there come a point, and maybe it isn't until the whole thing bursts, but does there come a point where you know that what you're buying from Citibank isn't really the equivalent of a U.S. Well, what you're buying is it's the over collateralization. It's the
let me try and jump in and help.
Yeah.
When I buy that pool from Citigroup.
Yeah.
What the difference between my price and someone else's price is going to be is how I think the loan will tranche out. How much of it will be AAA? How much will be AA? How much will be single A? And I'll make an educated guess. And if I guess wrong, I'll either make more money than I thought, or I'll lose more money than I thought, or I'll lose a lot of money.
Yeah.
So if I said, look, 80% of this pool is going to tranche out AAA, and it's all going to tranche out single A or better, and I find out when I go to get it rated that it's, you know, 23% AAA and there's double Bs in there, I way overpay for that pool. So I'm making an educated guess on the purchase of that pool, how I think it's going to tranche out.
And then how that's going to rate,
basically. Right. So
weighted rate.
So Citigroup comes to me, and here's what they'll say. I've got, you know, a $100 million pool. It's got 1,000 loans in it. Average FICO is X. Average LTV is Y. And the regional diversity is X. Good.
Right. Okay. And so what's important to you is how the rating agency rates it overall, not necessarily how the underlying creditworthiness, except does that affect the rating agency's rating?
Yeah. That's the bottom line.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay. All right.
And understand, I mean, you were going in the direction of this, then you backed off of this idea that, well, maybe it's AAA, same as AAA corporate bond or AAA government security, and that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Right.
I mean, we're talking AAA asset-backed mortgage.
I wasn't going that way.
Okay.
I'm not sure where I was going, Rich.
All right. But just to loop back to tie up a little bow here, I take it would be correct that you didn't otherwise set underwriting standards that you would force your generators to provide to you. I mean, something lower than 100% LTV, et cetera. I mean, you didn't do that as a firm, correct? I mean, it would just be you look at it and whatever you can construct.
We bought the loans based on what they disclosed.
Okay.
So if they were 100 LTV loans, subprime, we knew they were 100 LTV loans, subprime in California, we probably said not interested. So we just made our market decision based on bidding for portfolios. So we passed on thousands of portfolios.
Oh, okay. Is there a chance, and I have to use his name because that's the only name I know, if Mr. Paulson was picking the loans in a pool...
Which Mr. Pulse?
Right.
Got it. Right here, got it.
By the time he was done, that was a higher yielding pool than if he hadn't picked those loans.
Is there a chance? I think if there's a chance of anything.
No, I understand. But as you're talking, it strikes me that the loans that he would pick would be the ones that would have a tendency to have a higher yield.
Yes. Because If you were looking to short a security, you would want to short the highest yield.
And the buyer, you need to looking at yield, may be enamored of that. That's very hard at times. Now peace just fell into place. That's all.
You're good. Okay. Let me turn to late 2006, early 2007. The firm.
Who was that? Paulson's
Well, no, Paulson's picks in the end didn't underperform.
But somebody going for yield, they look pretty attractive.
Well, it turned out, though, if you read all this stuff and the press and stuff, we didn't see until later. It turns out that, I think, if AC had gone to Paulson's portfolio, they would have done better.
They would have done better.
Than going
he actually picked,
yeah.
He picked a better portfolio than they had, and they picked for themselves.
Case. That is ironic.
It is ironic.
Now, even more ironically, just because of you like irony here, which is, if you look at where ACA's place in that, because remember, they weren't in super senior, they were in sort of they had some super senior and some other stuff. If you look at IKP, where they went, if the portfolio consisted of all ACA picks plus all treasuries, for everything above them, they still would have gotten that wiped out. See, now, really, the only sad part of all this is, it didn't matter any portfolio, because as it turned out, the market collapsed. So you could have done the best job in the world constructing these things, the safest job in the world, and you wouldn't have lost all your money. And that's what it turned out. That doesn't matter. That's why we sort of run all these analyses for people. But,
let's turn to...
we're just trying to keep up on other things, unfortunately. Sorry.
Do you need to take a break?
Board meeting.
No, okay.
Yeah, no, we have a board meeting tomorrow. We have to prepare some stuff for us. That's what keep bothering me. I'm sorry.
Let's turn to decisions to get more neutral in the CDO and RMBS space, which we understand to be circa late 2006 or late 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Were you involved in that decision-making process?
I was present at one of the meetings.
Was that your only involvement in that set of decisions? Or?
There's no such thing as only involvement. Goldman Sachs is an organization that commutes as well as us.
Okay.
They communicate. So I was involved in the initial decision to get smaller, and I was involved in conversations down the stream in how effective we were doing at getting smaller.
Okay. Now, when you speak of getting smaller...
It's smaller in risk units.
Okay. To what extent does that involve getting short from your perspective?
If our initial starting premise was a very long position, or a long position, or a moderately long position, then the only way to get your risk units down is to get short. If we'd started with a short position, our only way to get risk units down would have been to buy. So in the world of risk units, you have to do the opposite, or something that that has an opposite reaction in the market to what you're trying to de-risk.
Sure. But as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that by, say, third or fourth quarter 2007, you are short enough so that you've actually made money on the short side, lost some amount on the long side, but it's less than what you gained on the short side. Is that a correct statement of where you were circa late 2007?
I think that's where it was for 2007.
Okay.
But the numbers are, we're honing in on not on trying to just mitigate the amount of pluses and minuses. We're trying to get both sides to sort of net down to zero. So the pluses and the minuses every day we would have loved it is sort of equal zero.
Okay. If that, I understand that is the potential goal, but was it the case that you got more short than long by the end of 2008? That would be a correct statement, right? And
you're asking me a specific question. I'm sure there were moments or days when
you said,
that
absolutely
you said 2008. You meant
2007. Okay, 2007. I'm sure that's correct. Mm-hmm. But our position changed hourly, minute to minute, day by day. So for me to sit here and say, yes, we were definitely short over this period of time, mm-hmm. would not be, I don't know if that's an accurate statement.
Okay. Now, in some of the email traffic, the phrase big short is used. I can represent to you that that is actually correct. But was part of the decision making to get smaller involved in that? Was it also a decision to get shorter or short versus long?
It was a decision to neutralize the book.
Okay, so if you were more short than long at the end of 2007, then you just overshot the original goal, basically?
Again, it's very, this is, and I'm trying to try and keep this simple. Mortgages are a multi-factor model.
Of course. Yeah,
so I could have no position today, and the market opened tomorrow, and I have a position. So I did absolutely nothing, and my position changed. And so if our longs started defaulting, they go away, and your short doesn't go away. So all of a sudden, you were flat last night, three of your longs defaulted overnight, you were hedged, and you will come in tomorrow and you're short. Then, by the way, I buy non-performing loans, and all of a sudden they start performing. And I was flat. Now I'm long. So as interest rates changed, as prepayment speeds changed, as defaults changed, our position changed. Whether we traded or didn't trade. Without even trading, your position changes in the mortgage market. That's why it's one of the more complex securities out there. Mm-hmm. Because it's got an embedded option in it.
Were you involved in setting up a strategy for going short? I mean, the emails also suggest single name CDX, use of the ABX market. Were you part of this ongoing conversation that led to some of those decisions?
I was part of some discussions on ways to neutralize our position.
And part of that effort, just to go on the other side momentarily, was to reduce your long positions, correct?
The best way to neutralize a position is to buy what you're short or sell what you're long. So our first objective would have been to liquidate what we have. That's by far the best risk management tool in the business.
Okay. And was, I take it that was a priority?
It was a priority.
Okay.
And it's always a priority.
Okay. Now, my understanding, again, my information is mostly from the email traffic, but that there were a number of clients of the firm that were actually very frustrated by how their investments with you all turned out. There's one in particular where I think five European clients lost $1 billion, and I know Mr. Sparks apparently had to deal with that and say fairly testy folks. Did that kind of problem rise to your level as well? And if so, did you have to take any steps to address those kind of client relationship issues?
I don't recall any client issues that I was personally involved in.
Are you aware that the firm faced client relationship issues because of some of these losses?
I don't specifically know what clients they were, so the answer would be no.
Okay.
Let me ask a generic question. You have this marvelous system of controllers and risk management. In risk management, do you include reputational risk?
Absolutely.
So if this kind of issue would rise to a significant enough level, somehow it would surface
mm-hmm.
to you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What would that level look like?
It depends on who, what, and where. There's not a generic red light that goes off. It depends on the situation. It depends on the client. It depends on what happened. Now, in the mortgage market, you don't need me to tell you anything you bought went down a lot. So it wasn't a unique Goldman Sachs security. So had those clients owned a portfolio of securities, I'm sure they were just as equally angry at all those other counterparties. So the fact that it may not have risen to my level is somewhat explained by the fact that the market had such a dramatic move that no one had foreseen.
It may be helpful to think about it, the basis of lawsuit, which you've all read about and we've been asked about.
Mm-hmm.
That's the lawsuit. That's the complaining client. That's the client. That's one client right now who sued us. What Gary was trying to demonstrate before, given who we sold CDOs and all these products to, they aren't complaining in part because they got what they thought they were getting and the market collapsed and they lost money. And that's the general story. So they're not coming to us with particularity. And Gary just made the add-on point, which is really important. We're not in the at the top of this marketplace at all. And so that when people are, quote, pissed off, as Kate was pointing out, they had way more people to be way more pissed off at if they look at the overall portfolio. But I mean, that's the point. But the real point is, you know, our clients are very sophisticated, and those are the people we dealt with, so they would have to, like, make it up to complain.
As long as we're making observations, the irony is that a couple days ago, a bunch of investors in Basis Capital funds sued Basis Capital for selling them interest in those funds.
Well, and just that irony, IKB is being sued by their fund holders and investors too, and in federal court in New York. So everyone's being sued.
It would have been more surprising if someone bought mortgages and they didn't go down. That's when we put on the market.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to some bigger questions about derivatives.
Okay.
Goldman seems to have taken on a worldwide leadership position in various kinds of derivatives. Was there a strategic decision to do that, or has that just been part and parcel of the growth of Goldman over the last 5 to 10 years?
It's been part and parcel of our client base over the last 10 years. I would like to tell you we're smart and we understand where the market's going before it gets there. We're not. We have a robust client franchise, and our clients drive us into business life.
Yeah, I was going to say something to help you, a little interest on that, which Lloyd probably given the jobs. And I've been here around a long time. When we were going public in 99,
uh-huh.
and the firm we thought we were going to be and become, because in the roadshow and so on, and you look at the respect, our thought was that, in fact, trading is going to be less important. The idea was to grow asset management and be big in investment banking and so on and so forth. That was the way we thought we were all going. But that's not where the markets went, and that's not where our client base went.
And that's not where we went because we just followed. And I was sitting there, and Lloyd wasn't, you know, that's back when Hank was the roadshow. You didn't ask, I don't think, David that question that way. He would have been on the roadshow, and the other two then co-presidents are gone. But the whole theory of the firm was just sort of. So we ended up in a place we didn't expect to end up, so we didn't like plan on getting there. It's really the kinds of things clients want to be doing take you where you end up, at least for a firm like ours. That's all.
Interesting that your perspective's changed over time.
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
Well, if you don't have clients, it will
change again.
Yeah.
You know, we do our strategy presentation every year, and you know, at the end of the day, it's really pretty simple.
Yeah.
You know, be there to facilitate your client needs.
Mm-hmm. Do you think derivatives had a part in the financial crisis, and if so, what part might they have played?
It's hard to say they didn't have a part. But derivatives have been around for a long period of time. So we've been involved, or the market's been involved in derivatives for a long period of time. And if I think it had a part, and it's, you know, part could be a good part and part could be a bad part, because when you're dealing with zero-sum securities, you have to look at both sides of the equation. Derivatives allowed leverage, more leverage to be created in the system.
And how did that happen? How did that work?
Well, the word derivative means you're taking a derivation of something.
Right.
The something is a cash security, a fully paid for cash security. So by derivatizing in itself, you're going from fully paid in cash to something I'm not fully paying for. And that's how it worked. And as the market became more and more sophisticated, it found new ways based on client demand to create less at-risk capital and more control of underlying outcomes.
And can you give me a few, what would be the best examples of that use of derivatives? What would be the derivative products that would have maximum leverage from that perspective?
Well, the one that was the most maximum probably that I've seen, and there's others that I haven't seen, but any embedded security that gives you multiple leverage. So there are ETF products out there today that give you 20 times the performance of the index, 30 times the performance of the index, whether they be long or short. Pro shares, they're called. Mm-hmm. You know, so you not only can you get the S&P 500, you can get 20 times the movement of the S&P 500 in a ETF today, long and short. Those are highly leveraged derivatives. So for a small amount of capital, you can participate in the movement in equity markets. That, to me, is probably one of the most highly leveraged or highly geared derivatives. Now, I don't know other people's protocols when they sold people derivatives. And what I mean by that is how much original margin they had to put up, how much they had to pay, what their variation margins were. I'm sure you can find situations where some dealers had very liberal margin arrangements, so clients were able to control huge amounts of embedded underlying with very little capital.
And other than the ETF contracts, any other examples, anything specifically in the mortgage space? Or
I could say, look behind you where they trade the oil contract. You know, the NYMEX oil contract has a lot of leverage in it, you know, for what you put up to control that many barrels of oil, or the S&P 500. And yes, the mortgage derivative product was right there, where you went from a cash mortgage business. Mm-hmm. For decades, we had a cash mortgage business. And for decades, we had cash bond businesses. And then we went to the CDS market, which was the first form of derivative. Then we went to synthetic CDS, and then you go to CDS squared and CDS cubed and all of those different markets that just evolve through the leverage cycle.
And would it be fair to say that all of the ones you just described in that list had potentially 20 to 1 type ratios, or is there a range?
That's probably, I won't say all
right,
but a lot of them have 20 to 1. I think if you look at futures margin today on standardized futures contracts, it's probably in the 20 to 1 category.
I think you missed what Gary said, which was if your counterparties collateral arrangements in a swap are sufficiently, you know, weak, you could have almost infinite leverage.
Infinite.
Okay. You don't have the margin at all. You're putting nothing down.
Sure. And that point's well taken. But if I wanted to...
Or if they don't pursue that.
Right.
If I wanted to determine that in some more substantial way, what would I look at to determine the point that Rich just made, plus your 20 to 1?
Well, the futures margin's probably... Okay. That we can get it off, where you can get it off any website.
Sure.
Which you have to put up for original margin to control a futures contract. In the individual counterparties, you have to go into the credit departments of those firms and ask what their collateral arrangements were, counterparty by counterparty.
Yeah. You can tell we asked for a lot of collateral, right?
We were, surprisingly, we were known as the cheapskates. We were the stingy guys who wanted collateral.
So, with the ETF contracts, what would you ask for in terms of collateral?
Well, ETFs are exchange traded.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So you actually, they're fully paid in, but they're paid in on an index that multiplies it 30 times.
Okay.
But a futures margin, the exchange sets a minimum margin, then you as a broker dealer have to charge the exchange minimum, and you can charge additional on top of the exchange minimum based on you managing your counterparty exposure. But the big clients won't pay you more than exchange margin because there's hundreds of FCMs, future commission merchants out there, that will charge you exchange minimums.
Hmm.
And then, by the way, you can get offsets of one exchange versus another. So if you've got NYMEX crude oil versus IPE crude oil, which is now ICE, you can get a margin offset because they're similar products. So if you're long one and short the other, you could put up no margin on the exchange.
And get to this infinite multiplication?
Yeah, you can.
All right. Now, one of the aspects of derivatives markets generally is that they are at least thought to be largely opaque. Is that two questions here? One is that your view of these markets? I mean, are they more transparent than at least some pundits suggest?
Again, it's a generic statement. If we go to the S&P 500, it's very transparent. We go to the NYMEX crude contract, it's very transparent. We go to the bond futures contract, it's very transparent. We go to the currency contracts, it's very transparent. We go to the equity options market, somewhat transparent. You know, as you move out the level of intricacy and you move out the level of sophistication of the clients, you tend to get less transparent, because there's less people ready, willing, and able to price those securities.
Okay. How about CDS? Is that in the transparent part of the spectrum or the more opaque part of the spectrum?
Yes. That depends. Yes. So in the index tranches, in the big single names that trade as index products that are actually clearable now because they're standardized, it's pretty transparent. You know, pick up the phone, call 5 dealers, call 6 dealers, call 8 dealers, you'll get a price. And it will be, there will be the intersection of those, there will be a central point of intersection where they all meet.
Mm-hmm.
Some will be a little low, some will be a little high, but there will be a point where they all cross. When you get to bespoke single names on illiquid credit that trades once every 2 years, it's not going to be very transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? A couple people earlier today said one of the advantages of the synthetic CDOs is that it provides price transparency, so I'm trying to reconcile that with what you just said, because it seems like a synthetic CDO to be less of a market. I think Veneer said
did he say price transparency?
Price discovery.
A synthetic CDO.
Yeah, and I didn't.
Well, I assume what David was saying, and I hate to assume.
Right. Well, you can just give me your take on.
No, what I would say by that is, as you create more instruments that trade,
right,
you create more price reporting data points, and people can disassemble and reassemble tranches and securities to have an indication where underlyings are trading. So what he's saying is, take something that never trades,
right,
and have it trade 1,000 times in tranches, you'll be able. I would say the same thing. By having something trade, you can decompose.
Yeah, because actually, what it really means is, the more transactions you have, Right. The better we'll call it, whether it's price discovery or market price or whatever you want to describe it. Mm-hmm. Because after all there is one bespoke, one-off derivative, it's opaque in one sense. On the other hand, so the only in the buyer and the seller are the people who are looking at it. Meaning that the buyer in those kinds of cases normally is pretty bespoke and is doing other kinds of transactions with other people, which may be quite similar and will know about the components of that. But it's not as though any other party in the market who's not interested in that particular kind of structure would have any great insights.
Right. So it's not transparent. Right. I'll tell you another.
So there's a price discovery here at Goldman? Because they don't, I mean, if you sell a synthetic CDO, the prices aren't publicly, you can't go to Bloomberg or somewhere and find them, right? So I'm still trying to.
Oh, but our clients have
people
multiple
live in that market.
Right.
Know how to
move. Know where to trade.
Okay.
You know, look, the one thing about our industry is there's secrecy for about a second. Because someone's going to tell someone what happened, because someone's going to try and use it as leverage. One of the most interesting ironies is there are markets that are identical markets, transparent and non-transparent. Ironically, the non-transparent markets are broader and deeper. The currency market is a great example. Currency market trades active futures in Chicago. That trades less than 10% of the currencies that trade during the day. The OTC market is 10 times deeper and broader.
And what explains that difference?
People don't want to be seen in the market.
Why do you think people don't want to be seen in the market?
Because they want to transact in a fashion that allows them to execute what they need to get done without having to deal with, I would call it, quote unquote, noise. So we're getting into a theory here.
Sure.
The regulatory environment has regulated the markets in the transparent world to accommodate the smallest trader that exists. They have regulated the market to protect mom and pop, right, or your grandma and my grandma, who trades 100 shares, who trades, you know, $1,000, a dollar, euro, because they're going on vacation. So the regulatory environment creates so much transparency for that it doesn't facilitate the real ultimate user of the market. That doesn't need a price that wide for $1,000. He needs a price that wide for $1 billion. And he doesn't want to take the risk of starting here in a transparent market and ending up executing here. He wants to know when he gets done executing, he's here. Because he's buying an asset somewhere else based on the currency trade, or he's issuing debt based on the currency, and he needs surety of price. So we've created such a burden on transparency that all of the real users want to go to the non-transparent market.
Is that a timing problem that I can't execute as fast in the transparent market? What's the burden of depth?
It's a depth, breadth, transparency, showing your hands, pre-trade disclosure.
Yeah.
It's all of the above.
Yeah.
Which is, I'll even go further, which people talk about lit pools and dark pools in the equity market. Well, the dark pool exists because it's dark. Because the big institutional buyer doesn't want any light on his transaction. So if you knew that Warren Buffett was in buying a stock or selling a stock, would you take the other side?
Not quite.
Okay. Fidelity's in buying or selling a stock. You want the other side? So Warren Buffett's going to trade in the dark pool.
So you're the right person to ask this question that's been on my mind for a while. Why was the ABX index created? Why was it suddenly in somebody's advantage to have transparency rather than not?
It was created, so let's go back to where we started this conversation. The original mortgage market, there was two positions in the original mortgage market, flat or long. That didn't facilitate the growth of the market. So all of a sudden people said, look, I could buy more mortgages because I've got balance sheet capacity. I don't have risk capacity. So to be in a position to facilitate the huge mortgage origination pipeline that was being created in the 2000s, someone came up with an ingenious idea to find a mechanism to allow you to short mortgages. So all of a sudden people said, look, if I've got balance sheet capacity, I can buy more mortgages because I can hedge mortgage risk in the derivative market, and I'll play the cash versus derivative basis, which is exactly what people do in the S&P 500, exactly what they do in all the other indices around the world. It was no different than we've seen evolve in every other market. But that was it took to the mid to the 2000s to find a way to not to have a third position in mortgages being short.
And what's the difference between the people who are willing to have their trades be transparent and the ones, the large majority, they would thank you very much rather not?
I think the vast majority of people that want their trades transparent are very small players.
So it's the same phenomenon.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Okay. So you talked about currency transactions being having a very large dark pool. Are there other kinds of transactions?
U.S. government bonds.
I'm sorry, what?
U.S. government bonds.
Come on.
The futures market is tiny compared to the OTC market. Tiny. You take the swap market, and you take all the other bond markets you trade in the U.S. versus the futures market. It's a small derivative market. Again, you can't go in and execute. If you do a $5 billion debt issuance and you want to hedge it as a corporate, you're not going to go to the floor of the CME and try and trade $5 billion of pennies. You're going to call up J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and say, I need a bid on $5 billion. And you're going
to
get three
bids.
That's
why, under all those proposals that first came along and where derivatives have to be and be public, the first thing they did is, well, we quickly have to exempt the
government securities markets.
And that's been, since that's like, when it's ground zero, they quickly decided in 10 seconds we have to exempt it because they realized we're going to kill a market. I mean, they're going to hurt themselves. Their funding, the cost of the U.S. government to borrow is going to go up because that's the effect. Less liquid, the less deep, the less efficient mm-hmm. your market is, your costs go up. And so the government decided immediately, under whatever the proposal is going to be, okay. Which is logical.
I think it was the Fed who decided.
Well, yeah.
They're all the government.
Government.
Well, yeah, to me, they're all the government.
Yeah. Are there publications? Is there a map to these dark pools and the rationale? I mean, if we talked about currency, we talked about U.S. bonds, what are the others? And is that sort of widely understood in the industry?
No, but I gave you two examples where they're transparent markets, and the non-transparent markets are much bigger than the transparent markets.
Okay.
Corporate bonds, same thing. I can take you through that evolution.
I think you were referring to dark pools that portray
for equity. For equity, yeah.
Right.
Equity is the only thing that has an official dark pool.
Right. Okay. Right.
But corporate bonds, another example. We had a robust corporate bond market in the United States. We get trace reporting, which is mandatory transparency. Mm-hmm. The bid offer spread goes from $200 million up to $5 million. All of a sudden, no one can execute corporate bonds. How do you think we got the credit default swap single name market? It was the evolution of trace reporting. Once they put reporting in, clients wanted to trade large blocks, so they did it in derivative form. So the CDS market is bigger than the corporate bond market. The oil futures contract is multiples of the physical oil market.
Any other commodity?
I could probably take you through hundreds if I could think of them. I'm just doing ones I know for sure.
Maybe we should just go the other way, right? And which markets are the transparent side bigger?
That actually work. Yeah.
I don't know. I actually don't know. I don't know if there is a market where the transparent side actually dominates.
And is the common element where we have a large OTC component and a small transparent element that people don't want their trades to be observed? I mean,
I think there's less fear of observation.
Okay.
And more fear of inability to be able to execute.
At the price you want.
Yeah,
at the price will run.
The price will run.
Right. Right. You can execute up here, but you're.
Once someone knows, like, look, for the last 3 minutes, that guy over there has done nothing but sell. I shouldn't put a bid out. I'm going to get hit.
Yeah.
Interesting. This is a very different perspective from what we've learned in other places, but this is fascinating.
Our clients just want surety of price. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they want surety of price.
And they're willing to take more than what the transparent market, because it's more, but it's for a much bigger chunk.
It takes their risk off the table.
Yeah.
So, you know, if a UK-based company is buying a US asset and they're willing to pay, you know, £1 billion and not a penny more, they need to know what to bid for the US company. So they've got me on one phone and they've got someone else on the other phone saying, where are you, where can you offer me, you know, where would you buy £1 billion for dollars? And they bid. And if they get hit, they go, you're done. They don't want to guess where they're going to hedge that. That's a typical day in our life. And guy doesn't buy, or my price isn't wrong. He says, thank you very much. I'll call you back later if anything comes up.
So if there were pluses in the derivatives marketplace vis-a-vis the crisis, what were the negatives? Other than leverage, which you've mentioned.
Yeah, I think leverage is outside of leverage, I'm not sure what I would connote as a negative, because again, we got price transparency, we got more transparency, we got more transactional volume, we got more notional volume out there. We got leverage, which is, you know, you would say could be a very positive or a very negative. For those that was right, it was a positive. For those that was wrong, it was a big negative. Mm-hmm. We always remind people leverage works both ways, up and down. Sure.
And you would say that the regulation in the OTC market by market players, big players, is of a quality analogous to the regulation in the transparent market for the smaller players? Is that roughly what I'm hearing?
Well, the smaller transparent markets are officially regulated.
I understand.
The OTC markets are unofficially regulated by the clients.
And that works out as well, you would say, at least as well, maybe better.
Our clients feel that it works out substantially better for them. They believe that they get far superior execution in the OTC markets than they can in the transparent market.
That I understand, but I assume that related to the volume they wanted to do and mm-hmm. the way that would, mm-hmm. you know, they'd be front running or something else. If you see what I'm doing, then I can't execute in time. But setting that aside, the rules that the OTC market imposes are as efficient.
Yes, they are. Yes. So you give me a limit order in the OTC market and it trades through, I owe you a fill. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm supposed to buy at 6 and it trades 5 3/4, guess what? You should be filled. And someone, one of my competitors will most likely call them and trade them, tell them to trade at 5 3/4. And they're going to say, wait, you didn't fill me. So yeah, the self-governing process of the OTC market is very robust as far as facilitating clients. And remember, the world has gravitated towards bigger and bigger and bigger pools of capital. So when I first got in this industry 30 years ago, there was a huge retail order flow system on every market in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the Merrill Lynch wirehouses, the Payne Webber wirehouses, I can go back and name them all, the Loeb Rhodes wirehouse, they used to send thousands of orders from retail Monpa. Now, if Monpa actually trade, their money's with Fidelity, it's with Vanguard, it's with PIMCO, it's with BlackRock. So the same client comes in as part of a $1 billion order, not part of a $1,000 order. And believe me, BlackRock and PIM, all the equity executors, well, let me rephrase that. Everyone in the asset management world has a fiduciary responsibility for best execution. They have to prove to their clients that they have executed in the most efficient way possible. And they actually run data. All these firms run huge data pools to prove that they're executing in the most efficient way possible.
This is a real side to the derivatives, among other stories that we haven't mm-hmm. heard before.
Yeah.
This is great. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me ask you a few more general questions. Incentives created by compensation systems? You observed the Wall Street scene. Was that one of the causes of the crisis?
I really don't think so. Look, this is a tough industry. It's a competitive industry. We have to attract and retain the best, and there's lots of competition out there. And I think the way our and I can only speak for us, the way our compensation system works, we believe that we get to the right place on risk and reward.
Okay. And
the role of clawbacks, how best to make sure that people aren't taking getting short-term gains and incurring long-term risks or medium-term risks.
Well, I'm sure you heard that we've always had a clawback system. Unfortunately, we were not smart enough to call it clawbacks. We called it forfeiture. So we now call it clawbacks. But on our equity-based compensation, we have always had, since we've only been an equity-based company for 10, 11 years, mm-hmm. we've always had the ability to take back your stock if we found after the fact that you did something that was wrong. So it's not a new concept to us at Goldman Sachs.
And on that point, I've actually read some of your compensation things, but it sounded like the wrong thing would be something unlawful or close to it versus you try to do the short-term profitable thing mm-hmm. and incur a long-term or medium-term loss. That still is not part
well,
of the
remember,
system.
Well, remember, we pride ourselves on real-time risk management. So that short-term thing you're doing shows up on the risk management screen. And it gets approved by a variety of people, and everyone sees the position. And so to the extent you engage in a short-term opportunistic event, other people were involved in agreeing that that was a proper event to be engaged in. No one's in isolation. Okay. So
I understand the thing you were looking at, it actually goes way beyond legal, but it's all very general. And I would say
the language is very general.
Yeah. Which is still getting to the, you know, your result is sort of right. Remember, one point we make, so we're this market firm, okay? Mm-hmm. If it's true that, you know, so people get rewarded at the end of the year, not formalistically, you know, not formulaically, people look up exactly what you created. But since we're marketing the market all year long, it's not sort of the same as some places where they put on these positions, they get their big P&L, but they've never marked it down, even though the market
or
corrected. And then they market, they only market when they sell it later, or they do whatever they do, and it's a year and a half later. And then you can argue about it, about whether, gee, did they really do well at the beginning, when did it begin to deteriorate, whatever else. But, you know, there's a concept of calendar year. The hard part about life is you pay people over some cycle, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, but that's when you get to the use of all the equity and all the other things, so that, as was described by all the various people, how, you know, people like Gary and I, we got no bonus in cash. We get all equity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it vests in 5 years. Well, it'd be pretty stupid if you thought you were going to do things that would be good 2 years from now but blow up 3 years from now. Definitely pretty smart to figure out what that might be, by the way. And even though it's longer now than it was a few years ago, the equity is a very big, you know, talk about clawback, but it's always a very big weapon in terms of just the fact your diminished value of your stock. Okay. If somebody actually does something wrong, like mismarked a book,
forgot their trade, put a trade in the bottom drawer, that, you know, all those things.
That all gets clawed back very easily.
Right.
I mean, those seem like the easier cases.
The harder part, even though I've read about the theories of clawback, the sizes of the theoretical matter as described, I've never completely understood it because, you know, when somebody invests in a company and you think it's, you know, because we're the long-term investments, and eventually you realize, well, let's pretend it's doubled in value after 2 years. You've left the firm and gone elsewhere, okay? Then people decide to sell it or not or hang on to it for the next two more years. Those are different people, okay? If they'd sold it then, they would have made the doubling in value. If they held it for the 2 years, it may be a quadrupling, by the way, or it may... You know, it may lose money.
Dying.
You know, and so I think that's a very challenging area on the conference.
So I'll reiterate what Greg says. Mark the market firm, everything priced at replacement cost. You choose every night when you go home to have the position or not.
Yes.
That's very important.
So you guys didn't get killed by the bubble?
Well, there was no bubble because we were marking down every day as we were calling collateral. There was no bubble. Everything moved linearly if you marked every day.
We lost a lot of money.
Yeah. But we didn't get killed by the bubble. We managed to do it over many, 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 many days. And number two, the point I would make is our balance sheet or inventory turns over very frequently.
That was going to be
we obsessed on aged inventory. And we obsessed on level 3 assets.
Now, has that always been true, or that's something that
always,
been
true. Always, always, always been true. It goes to the partnership culture. That this was the partner's capital, the partners were at risk. If you can't move it, you shouldn't own it, and mark it down and get it out the door.
That was always cats and dogs. That's right. Boy, yeah. The point
yeah.
was
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Understood. We got that. Yeah.
Where did we read sort of this list? We heard about liquidity management. I mean, there are all sorts of really interesting practices. Are these the, quote, risk protocols you've been talking about? In other words, is there some place where...
That's what he was referring to. David was asked, what are the big things you look at when you think about risk?
Yeah.
He hit the big three, you know, liquidity, because that's been true from round
zero.
Liquidity
is number one.
But where do we read this in sort of a documentary form to...
We'll think about it. I don't know.
I don't know if we... You know, you don't give away the secret recipe for Coca-Cola either, right?
No,
I'm not asking for numbers. I'm asking...
No, here's a good question. I'm sort of sitting here thinking, and we'll ask Craig and so on, maybe in training for people. We might give presentations internally.
Internally, this is doctrine.
Yeah, it's
that's
not
in the employee handbook.
Something different, which is we haven't written down.
It's a function of the employee
handbook,
right? Look, aged inventory.
It'd be a pretty boring first section.
All right, so aged inventory, yeah. Really simple. Yeah. We start charging you more to hold the inventory after a certain amount of days.
You charge the trader.
We charge the trader a bigger financing cost. So if you really want to hold it, you better understand it's going to... And by the way, it's geometrically more expensive over a longer period of time to hold something. And that's not that hard to figure out.
When you get to Craig Broderick, he may be better on some of those, whether it's CRIM 3 or whomever. No, just in terms of where stuff is written out. Because actually a lot of good stuff, I can't remember, one of the European groups, they put out... Some of these things that come out with it, we think these are the best practices or whatever. We would discover that many of them, they come to us to ask what we did too, if many of our stuff got in there. But it's not like, and people may have done internal presentations, maybe Craig's done one, for example, mm-hmm. somewhere internally to say, for the younger people when they come in, here are the things we should be doing, and here are our best practices. And I was sort of sitting there thinking, gee, do we have anywhere in our...
Well, there is, in the PSI production, there is a report that Craig and Lloyd did for the McKinsey group. And it was all about how how do we think about risk management? Think about scenario analysis, stress tests,
the different types of risk
price
management
verification
tests that we use,
and you know, top sheet analysis, all this type of stuff. And so that would be, we can get you the copy. That's but right. That's in that.
Yeah, that's exactly
perfect. Thank you.
Perfect. That's very helpful. Thank you. I've had answers to this question earlier in the day, but give me your sense. How does the firm, assuming it can, assess counterparty risk? You have that capacity, as I understand.
Well, look, Craig is the expert.
Okay.
And Craig handles this. And what he's going to tell you is we have the capacity. We do our own internal credit ratings for each and every one of our counterparties, which is, you know, and he'll take you through excruciating detail. It's physical visits, due diligence, disclosure, relationships with the financial people to all of our counterparties, and assigning our own credit rating for them. I just described in 30 seconds something he could take a day on.
So one of your counterparties is AA or AAA?
We don't have AA, AAA. We have numbers. It's a numerical system.
Okay.
But we don't, you know, we equate them to how much risk we're willing to take, what margin triggers, and how much notional business we'll do with them. It's got, literally, it's an onion. It just keeps peeling back. And we measure everything with them. We measure, you know, notional, we measure trading volume, we measure settlement risk, we measure jump to default risk. We measure across hundreds of categories. Mm-hmm. And they come up with their internal credit rating based on how they fit into each and every one of those categories. But I'm not the expert.
Okay. And
I'm not the expert. I know that.
Yeah. So
you know, you know that.
If you wanted to try and capture, say, 95% of your exposures, would that be five or six firms in terms of counterparties?
I don't know. I doubt it, but I don't know.
Doubt it being there would be a fewer number? Or
no. For 95% exposure, it would be a lot more. I don't know.
No shot. Okay.
I don't know.
You might be able to ask Craig the same thing.
Yeah.
Because
somebody's
got to
report on that.
No. If you look in our, we've gotten some of our risk reports. We can, you know, give you more of them. But in there, part of the risk reports, you know, you're looking at your major counterparty risk is something we obviously
think about. It's probably not who you think it's going to be either, but Craig should go through that.
But the other thing I remember when you're thinking about risk, counterparty risk, collateral and other things can make your risk a lot different.
Different.
That's the whole point.
That's why I say it's not going to be who you think it is.
Because you know, we might trade with J.P. Morgan all day long. At the end of the night, they get collateral. We give them collateral, so we don't have any risk.
Oh, that makes perfect.
Yeah, I said it's not going to be who you think it is. Okay, it's not going to be J.P. Morgan. It's not going to be any of the broker dealers.
When you, I got just a couple more, and one on the ranking the counterparties, and we'll ask Craig about it tomorrow or whatever day we talk to him. But when it's all said and done, is there a number, or I mean, how do you actually rank them? You know, when you go through and you do the due diligence for every counterparty and you do all that, is there just a page full of information, or is there a number?
There's a system. There's a very robust system that Craig can take you through.
Right, but when it's all said and done, is there just like a number? All right, so
there's not a number. No.
Okay.
So if the two of you look fairly identical,
very much so.
Yeah. Right. You probably will probably have different
right.
levels of risk for each of you based on different areas.
Okay. Okay. We'll talk to Craig.
Yeah.
A couple of quick questions. Given what I've heard about how you guys use derivatives, I don't know if you do this, but internally, do you try to measure profit and losses on derivative transactions, or is that just not the way it's looked at here?
It's not the way it's looked at.
Okay. And Craig may be the guy to talk to about this, but if the non-Wall Street types, you know, wanted to sort of understand better, you know, your guys' risk management system of always being, you know, fairly within here and your ranges on the various businesses, what kind of reports do you guys have that would show us that? You know, whether it's the mortgage business, whether it's the leveraged loan business, whether it's whatever, if we wanted to see how you guys would only, you know, not get outside certain risk bands, are there reports, you know, internal reports that show how you're doing that? I just know the folks that are our bosses, you know, are interested in the risk management of all companies, and particularly of companies that didn't disappear. You know, to see what the folks that did it right, how they did it, compared to the folks that didn't do it right, did it.
We have numerous reports. Okay. Again, Craig's going to be your expert here.
Okay, so we'll ask
him about that. The reports that we have, that the major reports, are summarized in this presentation to McKinsey. So credit spread widening, VAR, all of those.
Here's what I'll tell you. I will shed this light on. Risk management is not a science. It's an art form. And that's been, Craig and I talk about this all the time. So at the end of the day, you can have the best reports in the world, you can have the worst reports. Someone's got to make an interpretation, and someone's got to provide some type of judgment on what those reports say. So, you know, Craig will take you through 20 or 30 reports that I use regularly. But every now and then, I want report number 63, because I said, you know what? I've got to think of this in terms of that. Don't we run this scenario, or don't we run this report? And Craig says, oh, yeah, it's on page 63 of the packet. You know, let's turn to page 63. And we look at it, and we go, aha, you know, here's what we've got to protect against. And what I think we're good at, and other firms are good at, we're really good at modeling the past. We try not to lose money the same way twice. We invent new ways all the time. And where the art form is to try and prevent the new ways. And it's not, and I would say 50% of it's in the risk reports and 50% of it's in the people looking at the reports.
Were you ever in the controller side of this business?
No, I have not been.
That's where he's going next.
No, it's interesting because you talked to Dan Sparks, I think. I wasn't here for that, because even with all our great, you know, risk systems we think of and so on and so forth, it's the judgment thing, because he was running the mortgage department. I think one of the things he would talk about is, well, I don't think our risk systems, you know, captured everything adequately, and you had to apply a judgmental level on the whole thing.
Yeah, he sounded like he was nervous about stuff.
And the report might say this, but this is what I feel. And if a person says that, a guy like Dan Sparks, he would then go to whomever who might be, he'd then talk his way through it, and the person might actually agree with him. Because as I think I was describing in the David interview, when you look at our risk group, what we have for our risk committee, which is independent, actually functionally meets, because one of the great committees. It meets every Wednesday morning at 7:30. When I first got here, I can assure you it was still, they tried, but it was a much, much thinner, short document. The world is more complicated, but you know, now it's huge amounts of analysis on all sorts of things. Yet, having said all that, as Gary just said, it's got to be somebody exercising judgment on top of it to decide to do it all.
Here's a story that Dan tells. He said he thought at the time, in February, early March 2007, the department was slightly short. In retrospect, he believes it was very long. And it was very long if the market gapped down. And the reason was they had like these repo trades with ESAM. All of a sudden, that's back on your books.
The warehouse lines all came back.
If you look at what happened, think of it that way at the time, but now I feel it very strongly.
So we had warehouse lines, the very substantial institutions, J.P. Morgan. We had a warehouse line with, you know, Fidelity. They had securities on the balance sheet. We knew we had some risk, but we, you know, for a lot of period of time, you assumed that was going to be securitized off. All of a sudden, they go, can't securitize the jurors.
And these were mortgage securities or everything?
Mortgage, mostly mortgages.
Well, the thing that Dan was mentioning was mortgages.
Wow.
Same thing is, you know, you walk in tomorrow and you get a prepayment report or you get a default report, and $20 million, $30, $40, $50, $100 million of mortgages defaulted that night.
So a warehouse line that the counterparty is using to accumulate mortgages doesn't go in the mortgage risk report?
It goes in one report. At the time, it did not. At the time, it didn't go to the top, to the desk manager report. It went in the credit report. We had a lot of exposure reports with it in there.
Right.
But the vast majority of that risk was basically, there was only one scenario where it was your risk.
Because it wasn't at that desk
yet. If they literally defaulted on the warehouse, if they literally defaulted and put the securities back in.
Okay.
Anything else? Mr. Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for talking to
you. Great. Thank you for staying late.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank you.